Hi, everyone. This is your host and storyteller, John Hagedorn, and it's great to be with you today. It's time for some Believe It or Not stories, those wild, wacky stories that appear to be tall tales, until you check them out and find that there is some, or even much, truth to them. And there is usually some interesting history attached, and that's what we're all about here. Just call it a weird history lesson from 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. Our first story offers a solid idea for those who might be looking for long-time employment. With this job, room and board are included, and you get to enjoy the great outdoors, as well as gardening and lawn maintenance. Best of all, you can let yourself go. You can let your hair, fingernails, and toenails grow out. Men can grow a full beard, the longer the better, and you don't have to bathe often if you don't want to. Shaving is optional for women as well. Contracts can be very lucrative and range for a few days to many years, and I know by now you're dying to hear what the work is. Most of you are familiar with garden gnomes. They're usually found in garden shops and in catalogs like Wayfair. They wear red pointed hats and old-fashioned outfits, often including blue shirts and boots. The men usually have long, white pointed beards. The women are usually a little chubby and have kind faces. The gnomes sit on benches or stumps and sometimes carry signs like "Go away" or "Keep off the grass," and they're almost always found on big estates. But now you are starting to see real live gnomes appearing on those big estates. Some live in little thatch huts, so well equipped with modern appliances that it would make Frodo the Hobbit envious. Some actually do gardening work and landscaping and even security, and they make pretty good incomes with all health insurance paid, full benefits, retirement, pet insurance, you name it. Some are required to speak to guests, and some stay quiet. Sometimes when the owners of estates have big parties, they'll send all the guests out to find the garden gnomes. Some of them just act as garden decorations and do not talk to guests. But some will greet the guests, some will entertain, and some will just run away or lock themselves in their cottage until the party's over. It all depends on what kind of gnomes the owners want. For an owner of an estate, having a living garden gnome is the epitome of success. Forget the Lambo, the 50-foot yacht, and all the fancy toys. Imagine you're attending a cocktail party and the host stops the festivities to announce, "Our garden gnomes are working down by the pond, and this is a great time of day to go spot them." Don't offer them your drink, though. They are absolute teetotalers. And then a guest might interrupt and say, "Oh, we gave our garden gnomes a grand wedding this past spring." Being a garden gnome is the ultimate acting experience, sort of like theme park work, but in this case you get to enjoy nature. You do have to stay in character all the time, even when you think no one is looking, because all large estates have video security. If you're a parent of a teen who is constantly on the internet, has very little social life, and seems to have no desire to become a working member of society, life as a garden gnome could be just the answer. There is a history to garden gnomes, at least the store-bought ones. The story of how those sometimes whimsical, sometimes comical, sometimes vulgar statues became fixtures in yards and gardens is as colorful and complex as the creatures themselves. There are plenty of little characters in mythologies from around the world, including the Egyptian god Bes and brownies, house spirits in British and Scottish folklore, and their earliest introduction appeared as small stone figures in Italian gardens during the Renaissance, so they have a history. The figures that have become known as garden gnomes in the U.S. and England can be traced to dwarf statues that originated in Germany's Black Forest region around the early 19th century. They were initially carved out of wood. By the mid-19th century, they were cast in terracotta and porcelain. They weren't a garden fixture, though. They were hand-painted, usually about 3 feet tall, and expensive, so they were intended to be displayed inside as pieces of art. Although those figures were often depicted in what has become their trademark red conical hats, blue shirts, and boots, they didn't strike lazy or lackadaisical poses. They were gardeners, carpenters, fishermen, even hunters carrying shotguns. Sir Charles Isham gets credit for bringing the dwarfs into Britain and out into the garden, imported a number of them from Germany in the 1840s to decorate his massive rockery garden at Lamport Hall, his estate in Northamptonshire. Then there was Sir Frank Crisp, whose roughly 62-acre estate in Henley-on-Thames, Friar Park, was dotted with German garden gnomes and open to the public in the early 20th century. That really popularized them in England. By the way, George Harrison of the Beatles bought that property in 1970 and claimed to unearth a few of the original gnomes, which he posed with on the cover of his album, All Things Must Pass. Wealthy landowners began adopting the gnomes, as they were commonly called by then, as sophisticated garden accessories, all thanks to Isham and Crisp. Photos of them even appeared in Britain's arbiter of high-end style, Country Life magazine. In 1912, gnomes were featured at the Royal International Horticultural Exhibition, a forerunner of the Chelsea Flower Show, which began the following year and didn't allow gnomes to be featured because trendsetters of the time determined they weren't tasteful enough. The gnomes fell further out of favor during the two world wars, when the British spurned anything related to Germany. But they enjoyed a resurgence in the 50s and 60s. Mass-produced and often made of concrete, they were cheaper and smaller, making them more accessible to middle- and lower-class homeowners. Then gnomes went international, immigrating across the Atlantic, where Americans were infatuated by them, in part thanks to the popularity of Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Though there isn't a particular mythology associated with them in the United States, people lump them in with other good-natured mystical beings, such as fairies and Chinese dragons. Gnomes are thought to be, by some, lucky for your home and garden. Their popularity skyrocketed in the United States in 1976 when Will Huygens' book, Gnomes, featuring charming illustrations of gnomes by Rien Portvillet, became a sensation, selling more than 1 million copies. The collaborators claimed their fictional work was based on observations of actual living gnomes in their native Holland, documenting history, house building, courtship, and copulation, which was apparently so robust that the female gnomes almost always gave birth to twins. Portvillier's playful pictures of gnomes rubbing noses, helping injured animals, and building snug underground cabins painted them as endearing, warm-hearted characters full of good intentions. FYI, there have been a pair of successful star-studded animated films of gnomes, the first being Gnomeo and Juliet and Sherlock Gnomes. The Chelsea Flower Show finally warmed up to them, allowing gnomes decorated by the likes of Elton John and Judi Dench to grace the gardens at the show's 2013 centenary celebration. There was even a giant-sized gnome on display, a perfect prop for early adopters of Instagram looking for a selfie mate. You can search online for gnome jobs and find lots of them, mostly part-time. I looked and found some promising opportunities, like roaming gnome summer season auditions in Colorado, and Greenville, South Carolina, where Yard Gnome's game day event staff was hiring. I think a security gnome job on a large estate would be a good one. You'd get to carry a shotgun and go fishing during off hours. Well, each to his or her own. Anyway, if you like a private life and don't mind wearing a pointed hat, set yourself up somewhere as a garden gnome. Then write us at 1001storiespodcast@gmail.com and let me know how you're doing. I'd love to hear from you, and I'll share it on this show. I'd even come to visit. We all have our moments when things just get too bad and we lose our minds. For most of us, just momentarily. We rant, we rave, we might pound our fists through a wall. But this story involves a guy who went a little too far, stole a tank from the local Army Reserve unit, and headed downtown to create as much destruction as he could. His name was Sean Nelson, and he was an angry, apparently amphetamine-addicted, unemployed plumber. He became mad at everybody and everything, and he had pretty good reasons. He had lost both his parents in a span of 5 years, and was left seething about the poor care they'd received in the hospital. He himself had been hospitalized after a motorcycle wreck, and sued the hospital for negligence, but lost his case. And to add insult to injury, the hospital countersued, expecting him to pay their legal fees along with the bill he still didn't think he owed. Add to that, his wife was a legal secretary, and they had enjoyed 6 good years of marriage. But she left when the pills he was forced to take became the focus of his life. Then someone stole his plumbing tools, so he couldn't even work. Then the city shut off the electric to his house, and the bank foreclosed on it. At that point, Sean drove his Chevy van to the National Guard Armory in San Diego and stole a tank. It was May 17, 1995, and Sean's last day on Earth. Sean was an honorably discharged Army veteran, and he knew how to drive a tank. The Patton tanks at the Armory did not require keys and used a push button to start. He tried the first two, and they wouldn't start. But the third was a charm. He cranked it up and was immediately spotted by a soldier who ordered him to stop. But down went the hatch cover, and out of the Armory drove Sean and the tank. All that tension that had been building up in Sean came out in one long, destructive drive through town. First, he ran over a fire hydrant, which caused city water to geyser up high in the air. Then he ran over some cars and listened as the metal crunched underneath, just like so many beer cans underfoot. Now he was being followed by police cars, but they could do nothing. At the tank's top speed of 30 miles per hour, he drove down State Route 163 with a contingent of police following him. The southbound lane of 163 was now cleared. Sean came across a bridge and purposely tried to collapse the bridge by hitting the pillar a few times, but nothing shook. Shane then drove under the bridge and down the road where he tried to cross a concrete median, but unexpectedly, the tank got hung up. Tanks do have their limits. The police were doing some fast thinking, and they had his file open. Bets were that he was heading for the hospital to pay his debts, and the tank was carrying some serious weapons, a 105-millimeter cannon, a 12.7-meter anti-aircraft gun, and a 7.62-millimeter machine gun, and no one knew for sure if he had had the time to load any of these at the armory. Sean was now jumping up and down trying to rock the tank off the median. The police took this opportunity to get on top of the tank with bolt cutters, and they succeeded in opening the hatch, but Sean refused to come out. The policeman ended up shooting Sean, and that ended his rage permanently. Remember the Kenny Rogers song, "Let's Go Out in a Blaze of Glory"? Well, Sean went out in a blaze of glory, and we can only hope the hospital became better and wiser as a result. But you know how those wishes generally end up. We'll return with urban legend number 12, believe it or not, right after these sponsor messages. And now back to odd jobs. How about working as a real live Ghostbuster? Sound interesting? All that you need is an iron constitution and willingness to eventually accept the fact that ghosts really do exist. I say eventually because many beginning Ghostbusters begin the job trying to convince their clients that ghosts don't exist, until they either get their hair pulled by a spook when no one's within 20 feet of them, or they get spoken to when they're alone. We interviewed Rob Demarest once at 1001 Heroes, and he had some amazing stories about his experiences working on TV with international ghost hunters. They went to some of the most active ghost sites in the world, and Rob was definitely a believer. He said if you talk to them, it was helpful. You actually have to reach an understanding with them, or they just pull their usual tricks, killing all your batteries, no matter how many new spares you bring, and fouling up all your electrical devices. I remember his recalling visiting an army hangar that was used as a field hospital in the Philippines in World War II, and a voice from beyond asking him and his crew who won the war. Yikes! Anyway, if you're willing to travel, or if you want to start your own business as a tour guide, lots of cities and spooky places use tour guides. That's for starters. And unknown to many, there are many private homes and businesses that are convinced they are being haunted, and they want a professional to drive out the ghosts. Call him or her a Ghostbuster if you want. Their job is to convince the entity that they're upsetting human life and to please either move on or stop the haunting. Some people are very good at this business. The real ones seem to be fairly quiet about what they do, probably because they don't want to be thought of as connected to the modern-day rage connected to ghost hunters and gamers, of which there are many, especially in England, where some of those castles go back many hundreds of years, providing multiple generations of ghosts a place to frequent. The people in the ghost-chasing game today are fascinated with the serialized Ghostbusters movies and the gaming opportunities, as well as real ghost hunts through cemeteries and old buildings, which has become a fad. Here are portions of a Sally Howard article from England, where she writes, Ghost hunting is having a moment in graveyards, pubs, old houses, and on social media. Meet the new spirit seekers. As far as the four-man ghost hunting crew paralytic activities are concerned, ghosts have between the hours of 8 p.m. and 11 p.m. to make themselves known. "We're getting too old for the paranormal all-nighters," laughs John Smith, 51, who by daylight hours is a commercial sign writer. On weekends, he joins Neil, Luke, and Nigel, three fellow 30 to 50-something Walsall Ghostbusters fans who have carried their childhood passion for the paranormal into middle age to form paralytic activities. They meet to drink real ale and to explore the many reputedly haunted locations that litter the Midlands, from the ruins of Grace Dew Priory in Leicestershire to spooky pubs such as the Four Crosses in Kennick. The crew's technology, honed over a decade in the ghost hunting game, includes Old Faithful, a meter that measures fluctuations in the electromagnetic field, and Carol Ann, a 1970s portable television set that the team believes registers localized static interference. Carol Ann takes her name from the suburban child who became a conduit and target for supernatural entities in the 1980s Poltergeist trilogy. "The best bit is the social side," John says of his crew, who share their encounters via YouTube videos and through the Paralytic Activities podcast. "We don't take it all too seriously. It gets us out of the house and from under the wives' feet." Ghost hunting is having a moment. Have a go ghost hunters are cropping up all over YouTube and TikTok, while organizations ranging from luxury hotel groups to English Heritage are latching on to the lucrative opportunities presented by the Paranormal Pound. English Heritage hosts regular nighttime ghost hunts at two of their properties, Dover Castle in Kent and Bolsover Castle, south of Sheffield. London's Langham Hotel, said to be haunted by the ghost of a German prince who fell to his death from a hotel window, allows curious spook sleuths to book its most haunted room, number 333. It's a pop cultural juncture that's accompanied by increased scientific inquiries into the nature of unexplained paranormal phenomena and parapsychology. At 9 p.m. on a dark night in Stoke-on-Trent, I'm hunkered down with the paralytic activities team in the city's Stoke Haunted Museum, which bills itself as the sixth most haunted location in the UK. We're armed with a pentagram, Carol Ann, and a noisy smartphone open to an instrumental transcommunication app, which purportedly channels the voices of present spirits. For these believers, it's not solace in the afterlife, but the physiological thrill of ghost hunting in company that's the principal attraction. The rush of being spooked and spooking others in turn. On arrival at the black-painted Victorian building, Nigel thinks he hears breathing by the loos. That's English for bathroom, by the way. And John claims someone or something has touched the back of his neck. Yet it's quickly clear that there are, excuse the pun, a lot of dead hours in the ghost-busting game. After 40 minutes at a motionless Ouija board, which John dislikes, "I can't work him out, to be honest," he says. We follow the sound of a distant thud to a room. Inside, Luke thinks he can feel a chill by his legs, the left of which is adorned in tattooed scenes from the Ghostbusters movie. "I'm getting goosebumps," John hisses, his face ashen white, but delighted. "Yes, that's the draft there," Luke replies, side-eyeing a velvet curtain covering a door. Jaden Darnell, age 21, is among a younger generation of ghost hunters. He says he was turned on to the paranormal by the 2020-launched British indie gaming hit Phasmophobia. In it, a ghost hunter worked with up to three other players to identify one of 24 types of ghost, including poltergeist. That comes from the German loud spirit. And Yuri, which comes from the Japanese faint spirits. But the trainee teacher traces his own personal enthusiasm to his sightings of a ghostly apparition stalking the grounds of his childhood home. "People are replacing religion with spirituality," says Darnell, "but we are just as fascinated by whether there is life after death. I think the ghosts hold the answer to this mystery." You've all heard the expression, "careful what you wish for"? Well, there are times when many of us wish we had a cold beer. It just seems like there are times that call for that. A hot day, a relaxing moment, maybe just a sip of cold lager. And maybe, or maybe not, someone entertained that thought at a wake in London, October 17th, 1814, when a 15-foot-high wave of beer came pouring down two narrow city streets, killing eight people. We take you to St. Giles in London, 110 years ago, when the Horseshoe Brewery's 22-foot-tall fermentation tank containing 3,500 barrels of beer burst a seam, sending 320,000 gallons of brown porter down tightly packed George and New Streets like a tidal wave, picking up debris as it went. Three brewery workers were rescued from the flood, and another got swept along, but luckily got pulled out of the rubble. Beer flooded an Irish wake, killing four mourners. A barmaid was trapped inside a tavern and was crushed by the debris which slammed into her body. Two people were enjoying tea in their basement when the flood poured in, causing the house to collapse on them. In all, eight people died that day in a torrent of beer. Of course, there were those who just couldn't resist gathering the beer in gallon containers and saving it for later, including the poor guy who survived the flood, but later died from alcohol poisoning. Back to weird jobs. Have you ever considered working as a poisonous snake milker? It pays between $2,000 and $5,000 a month, and the venom is used to make anti-venom for those who have been bitten, a process which saves many lives every year. For those who want to make a difference, and even save people's lives, snake milking might be just the ticket. If you're lucky enough to have a serpentarium near you, or you're willing to travel to where the snakes are, here's a kind of work you will likely be doing. And it's humane work. No snakes or other dangerous reptiles or multi-legged critters like scorpions and spiders are harmed in the process. A snake milker who works in the field will certainly find employment at a serpentarium. This is a type of lab that houses and researches snakes and other related venomous reptiles. The lab itself may also have other duties, such as conservation, breeding, research, rehabilitation, and veterinarian services. If you're a recent college graduate wondering what to do with that biology degree, this could be the answer. The snake milker may have more than one responsibility in the lab. Some of these specialist labs will be at zoos, some will be at universities, and some will be small, independent facilities offering services on a contract basis. Snake milking is a small and heavily regulated industry. Due to the amount of training required and the need for the services, snake milking can pay rather well. Most of these jobs are paid by the hour. The median salary for snake milkers, who fall under the broader category of zoologists and wildlife biologists, is around $66,350 a year as of the year 2020. If you'll permit me, I'm going to imagine for just a moment what it must be like milking rattlesnakes for a living. The first job you have is to catch a huge rattlesnake for the purpose of milking his venom out of his teeth. You jump into a pair of high boots and find a pair of gloves and put a glass mask like welders use over your face. Then you climb down into the snake tank and pick out a snake. Today, a 5-foot-long rattlesnake with an attitude. You want to impress your boss, who's watching you from above the pit. You're carrying a long pole with a loop at the end, which can be drawn tight once it's placed around the neck of the snake. You hunt around for a while, and then manage to get the loop around the snake's neck, then walk up out of the tank, closing the door with one hand while holding the squirming snake on the pole with the other. Then you walk him to a table, where a large bottle is positioned, and hold the snake's head over the edge of the bottle until he extends his sharp fangs over the edge of the glass. You press just the right place on the snake's head, and the deadly venom pours into the jar. Another life somewhere is saved, and the snake gets released free back in the tank to produce more venom by tomorrow. That only took 30 minutes. And only 7 more snakes today, and you'll be able to fire up your Chevy truck and head for the roadhouse just outside of Cheyenne. Actually, there are zoos and serpentariums and needs for people who work with reptiles all around the U.S. The official line on the job goes this way. Snake milking is a highly specialized and niche career category within the zoology industry. Most snake milkers work in a laboratory setting extracting venom for use in medical research or treatments. Job responsibilities for snake milkers generally include using specialized laboratory equipment to extract venom from living snakes, calibrate and maintain laboratory equipment, become knowledgeable in the safe handling of venomous snakes, as well as medical treatment procedures in the event of a snake bite, handle, label, catalog, and store snake venom after extraction, perform care tasks for snake specimens as needed, including feeding, administering medications, and documenting health, diet, or behavior. Good luck if you decide to pick that one. Just don't get rattled. A much less dangerous job, yet one which is just as respected, is that of a pet psychologist. These talented dog and cat whisperers really know how your pets think, and they can help to counsel them. Scientists have proven that animals can and do experience emotions just like we do. And those of you who own pets know that some are smarter than humans and can even make humans do tricks like chase balls and talk funny. But there are always non-believers. If my wife says to me, "John, Duke has been acting very sad lately, and I think we should hire a pet psychologist," I would look at Duke, who's probably sitting up in his favorite spot and licking his privates, and say, "Duke doesn't need a shrink. He's fine." And my wife would say, "He hasn't eaten his food in 3 days, and he looks so sad, and I think he's sad over Fluffy being gone." Then I would answer, "He never liked that cat, and he's probably glad to have the whole house to himself." But my wife would win the argument, and the pet psychologist would come in to talk to Duke. Pet psychologists make up to $52,000 a year, and probably much more if they're working Park Avenue or 90210. I'll set up an imaginary situation. In comes the shrink, a nice-looking lady, professionally dressed, who sits down. We offer her tea or water, and she's soon lecturing us on how animals, especially dogs, can sometimes show depression, which manifests itself in unusual behaviors, such as loss of interest in their favorite activities. As politely as we could, and at the same time trying not to appear like idiots, we do ask her what kind of training she has and how she plans on getting into Duke's head. Her answer would go something like this. "Obviously, you can't ask a non-human how they think or feel. You can't have them fill out a questionnaire. So that can be a challenge. We do our best to come up with experimental methods or observational methods that somehow get the animals to basically tell you what they're interested in and what's important to them. I have 4 years of broad psychology and 2 years of concentrated work in animal ethology, studying animal behavior in their natural surroundings. I love dogs and love working with them. What's his name?" she asks. "Duke," I say. She goes over and scratches Duke behind his ears. Always a winner. And soon he rolls over on his back and shows her his belly, which gets a scratch, and they are instant pals. Then she asks for some privacy so Duke can have his little session with her. And from the kitchen, we can hear her softly talking to Duke while he growls a little every now and then, and once even barks twice to one of her questions. Then she lets him out the sliding glass door and calls us in to talk. She tells us that Duke has been suffering a sort of postpartum trauma and asks us if we recently lost another pet, to which we of course answer, yes, while simultaneously wondering just how she got this from Duke, who is a genius at handling people, but otherwise as dumb as a rock. I look at the pictures on the wall in the living room to see if any included the picture of Fluffy, but no luck there. The animal shrink then explains that dogs have feelings just like humans, and the loss of a housemate can be devastating. Then she suggests a solution, that solution being that we spend more time with Duke, time playing, and maybe working in some new patterns like taking him to new locations for walks. She follows up with things we can do to distract him from the loss and open up our relationship with him, and talk to him more often. They may not understand the words, but they pick up on the feeling behind the words, and they know it's meant for them, she says. Then the big one. We should consider finding a replacement for Fluffy. I guess I knew that was coming. Another blanky cat. At least dogs can learn tricks, and they're fun to walk. Try to teach a cat how to shake hands or wear a leash and go for a walk. A lost cause. When it comes time for her to leave, Duke is back in the house and nudging her leg for more petting and scratching while we write out the check for her services. She promises to check in on us every now and then and gives Duke a loving goodbye pat. We sit up late that night just trying to reason how she figured out the cat and deciding what to do for Duke. My wife is convinced this lady's a dog whisperer, a true animal psychic, while I insist that there's no such thing. She just uses reason and common sense, I say, and the cat deal is either a guess or the house still smells like cat and we're too accustomed to it to notice. We both agree to take Duke for more walks and seriously consider getting another cat. Then we watch some TV, realize it's getting late, and when I walk over to turn off the corner lamp, I notice Fluffy's scratching post shoved behind the couch. "Gotcha," I whisper, as my wife disappears around the corner on her way down the hall. Duke, bedded down in the kitchen as I go by, is sleeping soundly, and it looks to me like he's smiling from ear to ear. And while we're on the subject of dogs and weird jobs, how about dog food taster? Earning potential, $45,000 a year. There are approximately 90 million pet dogs in America, and as far as we know, none of them can speak. So the only way to know whether or not they like their food is to, well, sample it ourselves. Well, sometimes. As any pet owner will tell you, a cat or dog won't hesitate to show their distaste for a meal. Instead, pet food testers are primarily there to evaluate the nutritional value of pet food, not to taste it. Generally, it's someone with a doctoral degree, and their job is to evaluate a given pet's food nutritional value, writing reports, and determining ways to enhance new pet foods currently being developed. Starting positions can pay up to $58 an hour. Many times the want ad with the heading Pet Food Tasters is a computer-driven amalgam driven by the words food and pet and taster. For instance, a Virginia ad I'm looking at for a wine-tasting attendant. The job pays up to $16 an hour, reads Pet Food Taster, then goes on to describe work as a winery taste attendant who also can serve food, and the benefits include pet insurance, which is getting pretty common in job postings, by the way. Anyway, that's the story on why you see job offers for pet food tasters. Humorous, but true. If I told you that the Polish army in World War II had a bear carrying ammo boxes to the front line in his paws, would you believe it? Or not? At the beginning of World War II, Russia and Germany invaded Poland. If you had to pick a country that was geographically located in such a way that they were a target in every war in Europe, Poland is that country. Russia captured tens of thousands of Polish servicemen and held them as captives. Then, when Russia joined the Allies, those prisoners were released and had a chance to fight for the good guys on the Western Front, in Italy. To get to the front from their prison, they had to cross Iran, and in doing so, one particular Polish unit came across a bear cub that had been separated from its mother and father. The Polish soldiers took pity on the cub and nursed it, feeding it condensed milk from a vodka bottle. They named it Wojciech and took him with them on their march through Egypt to Italy. By the way, Wojciech, spelled Wojciech, means a warrior to whom combat means joy, in Polish. As Wojciech grew, the men taught it to drink beer, holding the bottle between his giant paws and draining it. Then he would look at it, trying to understand why it wouldn't keep pouring. They also taught him how to smoke, which was not good at all for Wojciech, because although he did enjoy a puff or two, he would then swallow the cigarette. The bear learned to turn on the portable shower and actually enjoyed it, standing. But when he showered, he used up all the camp's water rations, so they had to fix the water release rope so Wojciech couldn't use it, unless he was accompanied. And it's not that easy finding guys who want to shower with a bear. Although camp life was fun, Wojciech was growing up fast, and he was expected to do his part. So they helped him fill out the necessary paperwork, and he was given the rank of private, which justified his rather large rations and money to cover his transportation. Wojciech participated in training with the men. In one drill, the men had to throw an orange accurately as if it was a grenade, and Wojciech could catch, but he couldn't throw. So when they threw him the orange, he would catch it and then eat it. There were no special sleeping arrangements for Private Wojciech. He had to sleep in a tent just like his fellow soldiers, and they would have to pray that he didn't have any stomach disorders that night. Then came the Battle of Monte Cassino in Italy, and the action was so furious that the Polish army couldn't load its cannons fast enough. All hands pitched in to carry large shells and crates of ammunition to the men on the firing line, and when Wojciech saw them doing that, he pitched in as well and began carrying crates and shells to the front. He could do the work of four men, and he was fearless. To Wojciech, it might have been more play than work, many of the men thought, but the men's morale was boosted with Wojciech just being there. Wojciech later received a promotion to corporal for his actions at Monte Cassino. Wojciech survived the war, and soon the question came up of what should be done with him. They didn't want to send him back to Poland, because the Soviets had taken over, and they didn't want Wojciech to become a communist. They were currently then stationed on the border of Scotland, so they decided to lend him to Scotland. That worked out well for Corporal Wojciech, and he'd lived 17 more years in Scotland, playing soccer, attending children's birthday parties, and just hanging out. He died in 1963 at the Edinburgh Zoo in Scotland at the age of 21, and the people of Edinburgh built a statue to remember him with. They loved him so much that they built a couple of statues to keep his memory close. They even built one in Italy. My favorite statue, though, is the one in Duns Market Square in Scotland that shows Wojciech standing and holding an artillery shell. It was commemorated in 2016. Have you ever been knocked up? Once or twice this expression appeared when I was sharing my Sherlock Holmes stories at 1001 Sherlock Holmes podcast, and it appeared to me that the expression meant to be disturbed and woken up. I never did follow up on it until recently, when I discovered that people used to pay others to tap on their windows to wake them up. And that's what Sherlock Holmes and Watson did at 221B Baker Street when they shared the residence prior to Watson's getting married. The job title was a knocker-upper. The requirements were that you had to wake up early, be able to keep a schedule and be on time, walk around with a pole long enough to reach a second-story window, and be able to tap on the right window gently enough not to break it, but loudly enough to wake up the occupant. This job was initially created to wake up factory workers who lived in long apartments or row houses, but eventually it spread to fashionable neighborhoods in London and elsewhere. Sometimes the knocker was provided with instructions asking him to keep knocking until they received a greeting. But some people don't wake up well, and those who had anything other than nice words to offer the knocker couldn't count on him the next time. A knocker-upper needed about 100 clients to make any decent money. The knocker-uppers finally disappeared in the 1970s when it was no longer fashionable to have one wake you up in the morning, and that job, like that of the buggy whip salesman, became a thing of the past. I hear the Maytag repairman is still around, however. Thanks for joining us at 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries Podcast. We always appreciate reviews from Apple listeners and comments from Spotify listeners. And you can email me any ideas or comments at 1001storiespodcast@gmail.com. Also, we appreciate our Patreon supporters who, for about the price of a cup of blended coffee every month, support our 1001 shows going forward. They help greatly with the basic costs of running our podcast. Just go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/1001storiesnetwork, and pledge your support. I know everyone is asking for money these days. I get it too. But we do provide some really neat things here at 1001, starting with thousands of family-friendly stories of all kinds, classic literature, history and legends, stories of the Old West, and Sherlock Holmes stories, old-time radio shows, and so much more. Our 1001 shows contain a wealth of knowledge, as well as a rich storehouse of literature. And best of all, it's free. I do it all alone. And I provide stories and a friendly voice to travelers and persons worldwide with 1001. Here are the top six of our 12 1001 shows, and what was playing when I did this episode, which will be last week to you. I'm asking that you add at least one of them to your collection today. At 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales, you might have just listened to George Washington and Teddy Roosevelt offering some good advice. I especially enjoyed T.R.'s 10 Reasons You Should Go to Church. And along with that, I also did Rudyard Kipling's The Lost Legion. That's a great classic from Kipling. At 1001 Sherlock Holmes Stories and The Best of Arthur Conan Doyle, I just did The Secret Weapon, actually a movie, starring Basil Rathbone as Sherlock and Nigel Bruce as Watson. And I edited the movie, which had excellent sound, into an audio podcast, and it works fine. I have narrated all the 54 Sherlock Holmes adventures there and a wealth of ACD stories and memoirs there at 1001 Sherlock Holmes. Then there's 1001 Stories from the Old West, which is a really neat podcast, where you'll find a wealth of stories about the Old West, plus old-time radio shows like Gunsmoke and Tales of the Texas Rangers. This past week, and I think this week too, you'll find 3 Gunsmoke episodes there featuring Matt and Kitty. He never hung his hat at Kitty's place, you can believe it. But he sure liked her. and she liked him. At 1001 Stories for the Road, we have my narration of Tarzan the Untamed, Chapter 2. And I try to be very careful with the sound effects, but they don't all play the same on different radios, phones, and tablets, so it's very difficult to monitor them sometimes. But I'm doing my best to watch that so you don't get blown out of the tree by a wild panther. Tarzan the Untamed is full of action and drama. This story takes place at the start of World War I, and Tarzan is about to open a can of whoopee on the Germans who destroyed his ranch, and he believes killed Jane in British East Africa. That's 1001 Stories for the Road, Tarzan the Untamed. Awesome, awesome book. You can also catch the entire Mystery of the Blue Train by Agatha Christie there at 1001 Stories for the Road. We just finished it. And number 6, we're doing The Secret Garden, the story of a young orphan girl who is sent to live with her uncle in England and finds a reason to live for herself and others in the presence of a walled-off garden on the lonely property. It's a fantastic story. As many of you know, it's been made into a movie, but I can tell you the written story is better than the movie. Now playing at 1001 Love and Life Stories Podcast. That's 1001 Love and Life Stories Podcast. There might be a name change there soon, but you can find it if you search 1001 Love and Life. All free for you to enjoy. Tell a friend. Thanks, and we'll be back soon.